Yeah. Afternoon, everyone. My name's Dave Chinner. I'm a principal engineer at SGI, and I work on XFS most of the time. We have some XFS people here in the room. I think the rest of them are still at lunch, seeing none of the people actually work with day-to-day here. So there's no point introducing Barry right now because I can't point to him. Barry and I worked on a bunch of work on XFS repair to make it faster, and that's what we're going to be talking about here today. So, for those of you who don't know, there is a repair problem. We'll go through what that particular problem is and why it is a problem. We'll look at the first attempt that we made to try and fix the problem. A alternate solution that came from a community-provided patch. We looked at why we had some success, why something failed. We'll look deeper into that and move on to what we learned from it and the final design that we've actually pushed into the latest release of XFS Repair. And of course, then we'll look at the pretty shiny graphs that show the results. And maybe if we've got time, we'll talk about things that are coming up as well. Okay, so the repair problem. I'm sure Val can tell you all about this as well. The file system capacity is basically growing faster than the rate that we can really look at the stuff on disks. The speed, even bandwidth seeks, it's growing much slower than the rate of capacity. So what we end up with is a file system with a lot more objects in it and much bigger indexes, and that's growing faster than the rate at which we can actually read those indexes and read the data. Repair effectively has to read every single object in the file system. And so as the numbers go up, it doesn't get any faster because it's got to read everything. So if it doesn't get smarter, as the capacity grows, it just takes longer and longer. And of course, SGI doing things big, it was about 4 years ago that we had the customer being very unhappy at taking 8 days to repair their file system. Very unhappy. So unhappy they paid us lots of money to fix it. Okay, so what does XFS Repair do? Okay, it runs several phases. Phase one basically walks over the file system, finding primary metadata, the super blocks, the allocation group headers, discovering the geometry of the file system, and making sure all of the headers are there in the right place. Once it's done that, we move on to phase two, and from the headers we then have the indexes to things like the free space in the file system and all the inode locations, which are kept in B-trees rooted in the primary metadata. Once we've read all that stuff into memory, we can now start finding all the inodes in the file system, and that's what we do in phase three. We look at them all and check that they're all valid, they're not full of zeros or bad data and whatnot. In phase four, we take the inodes that we've checked the valid and start checking the extents, the metadata that indexes the data in the inodes, whether they be directories or just file data and so on, and validating that it all connects up and we don't have dangling free space or unaccounted for free space and so on. Once we've done that, we then go and rebuild the free space and inode indexes. We don't actually ever repair them, we just blow them away and redo them from what we've got in memory and what we've discovered. So that's basically a section where, you corrupted the free space, well, who cares, we'll just rebuild it. Once we've done that, we then go and walk the directory hierarchy and check that all of the directories are properly linked up, that we don't have orphaned directories or orphaned inodes or things like that. And if you do, you end up with lots of files with numbers in the lost and found. And then you have a lot of fun trying to work out what they were. From there, we now know that everything's linked up properly. We now go and check all the link counts to make sure that, yes, you've got four links to that file and there's four links in the directory structure to it and whatnot. So, the first attempt. What did we do? Well, the customer that had the problems 4 years ago was actually running IREX, and their issue was that it was effectively CPU bound, wasn't IO bound. Because Rx didn't have any sort of kernel block device caching like Linux does, we had to put caching into the repair program. We have lots of CPUs in these boxes, but they're relatively slow in comparison to today's CPUs. But we have a huge excess of I/O capacity, hundreds of spindles, that sort of thing, and the ability to actually drive them to capacity. So effectively what we did is that phases 3 and 4 in this case, XFS has multiple allocation groups that are effectively independent, and you could scan them independently in phase 3 and 4 and parallelize the I/O in that manner. The AG is self-contained, so it's pretty easy to do. So what we did was we added a hash-based block caching mechanism to XFS repair, using direct I/O to read the data in from the block device and cache it so that if we needed to read it again, we didn't have to pull it off disk. We used a thread per AG and processed multiple allocation groups at once. We did very little in way of actual optimization of the I/O patterns and so on. We were really relying on the fact that it was CPU bound and couldn't issue I/O fast enough. And so just use more CPUs to issue all the I/O. There was some small, really CPU usage optimizations by batching IOs into a, using the AIO list head, list LIO structures to issue multiple IOs at once. And then once that was done, we started bringing this all across to Linux as well. Version 2.80 of XFS Repair brought in the direct IO block-based caching mechanisms, and the multi-threading came in at 2.8.11. We're now up to 2.9.5, I think it is. Okay, so the alternate solution, which came in a little bit after we had started merging all of this stuff and pushing it out, was created by a company called Garmi Systems. That did things slightly differently. It didn't try to parallelize across AGs. It didn't use internal caching. What it used is multiple threads within an allocation group to prefetch and basically prime the kernel buffer cache for the block device. So when you get when we got Ninode, it got passed off to the prefetch threads, which then issued a read to read it in and then ignore it. All it did was bring it into the block device cache. The process, the processing thread at that point would then just issue reads as it normally would, and it would get it out of the cache rather than having to do the I/O itself. So the result of this is it tended to be faster on a single disk until the caching effectively started to break down when you ran out of memory, and if you had lots of disks, it was a lot faster. So this is where we look at the success and failure. There's some bad results here. The purple list that you've got here is the baseline that we're looking at. This is just on a single, on the right here we have a single, I'd say that's probably your left, a single SATA disk with 1.5 million inodes in it, roughly. The Agami patch showed that it went slightly faster, and all the stuff we did went slower. It wasn't much slower on a single disk, and then we started looking at larger file systems and so on, and it went lots and lots slower. Lots and lots. Not good results. And that was actually a surprise to us, because it was using exactly the same techniques that we used on IRX that had resulted in 4 or 5 times speed-ups, simply because it was CPU-bound and not I/O-bound. Whereas on Linux, we've got more powerful CPUs, and instead of being CPU-bound, we're I/O-bound, and the techniques that we were using really didn't match up. The threading made it even worse. So, that was backwards, wasn't it? Okay, so looking at that, looking at why we failed, the optimizations were focused on CPU-level parallelism, not I/O-level parallelism or I/O optimization and so on. We just didn't have enough CPU power. That wasn't the case with Linux. We had the opposite situation. We couldn't, we were I/O bound. And so with the threading, we were just adding more seeks into a system that was already I/O bound, and that makes it slower, doesn't make it faster. And that's where the problem came from. So looking at the Agami patch and what that did in more detail, it had 10 threads that prefetched objects from a queue of around 100 objects, and it added 10 objects at a time to the queue. So you basically, every time you added to the queue, there was something for every prefetch thread to do. The prefetch threads do no processing, they just prime the block cache, and the speed up effectively comes from the fact that we're removing the I/O latency from the processing thread. It's only ever hitting the block device cache, so there's no I/O that it has to wait for there, which means that it could process things faster, and that's where the majority of the speed up came from. The actual processing itself wasn't multi-threaded, it was just using multiple threads to do the prefetching. So, we rejected it. Yeah, we did. So why did we actually reject it? It was superior to what we'd done, clearly. No. But there were some reasons there that meant that we couldn't really use it. XFS is actually cross-platform. We have people, we use it on RX, we use the same user space source code in RX as we do in Linux, and there's people porting it to FreeBSD and they're using the same user space code again. So the solution that we needed had to be cross-platform, and neither RX nor FreeBSD have kernel block device caches. You simply can't use that technique on different platforms. Linux is unique in that. It's actually very effective on Linux, as Val can tell you, but we couldn't use it. That's why we did the caching in the repair program itself in the first place. The other reasons was that it was based on 2.7.18 and the 2.8 series of repair had changed a lot. The patch basically would have to be rewritten from the ground up to fit in with all the changes that we'd actually made. So there was a non-trivial porting effort. And then we started to discover issues with low memory conditions and not being able to control the cache. We'd started, you know, the read ahead would occur and then we'd run out of memory in the repair process and it would reclaim the cache and then we'd go to try to read the inode in the repair process. And so we were reading things twice from disk instead of once, and that slowed it down an awful lot. So we're getting read ahead thrashing and things like that occurring. And the last reason is that it didn't change the I/O patterns at all. The I/O patterns were still the same. All it was doing was hiding the latency of the repair I/O. So we're still seeing lots of backward seeks, jumping from one end of the disk to the other, doing all sorts of almost random I/O. It just did it faster. So, are we crazy? Of course we are. We work on file systems. So, what did we learn from this, really? The object-based prefetch queues reduce latency within an allocation group, and that's how they speed up the per AG processing. But we also then need the cross-AG parallelization, which allows us to issue more I/O, use more CPUs, and saturate much larger disk configurations. Because if we just use one CPU, we're then going to come across the problem again that we had on RX that we're CPU bound, not I/O bound. So yes, we could combine the two methods and go faster. And you know, we always feel the need for speed round here. So not just combining the two techniques, we decided to look a bit deeper and see what else we could actually identify as problems that we could solve. So we started doing I/O tracing, looking at the seeks that are occurring, what order we were looking up metadata, and so on. This was actually quite simple because we could do it with strace. We're using direct I/O on a block device. We have the exact offset of every I/O and the size of them, and we didn't need block trace to do it. So a bit of, you know, strace orc, you know, a little bit of graphing, and we came up with some pretty shiny graphs that told us exactly what was going on. There were common patterns in the metadata. There was often chunks that were contiguous. And even more often, there were single blocks of metadata that were separated by single blocks of data. And so we noticed that through the I/O patterns that were occurring. often the metadata for an inode, say an extent list or something sort of like that, would be slightly backwards behind the inode. So we'd read the inode, then read the extent list, and so we'd seek backwards to get it and then keep moving forwards. Not quite optimal in these cases. And often we had directories in, you know, their metadata. You get a full allocation group. Metadata starts to get spread all over the place. So we're reading the metadata from this inode and seeks all the way over the other end of the disk and then seeks back over here and then seeks back over there and seeks back over here. And, you know, we're just wasting seeks doing that sort of thing. So really what we're looking for were ways to make the IO more sequential and to issue less of it. And in that way, you know, it would go faster. Repair is effectively a seek-bound process. So, what did we actually do here? Okay, so the first thing that we did is we started to look into optimal prefetch. We added a pair of per AG prefetch queues, one for blocks ahead of the current location and one for blocks behind. The reason for doing this is that we wanted to remove backward seeks. We only wanted to do sequential traversal across the disk. So if we discovered that there was metadata behind where we were currently processing, we just ignored it. We shoved it into a different queue. It was a different queue. And if we ran out of the first queue, then we switch to the second queue and do a linear sequential traversal across that. So if we ever did a backward seek, it was only one before we kept moving forwards again. No, it's always try to go linear sequential in increasing order. Effectively what we're trying to do is a single pass across the disk. And we discovered because of dependencies in the metadata and so on, that wasn't quite possible. And that's where the second queue came in. With a second sequential pass across the disk, we could get 99% of all of the metadata in off disk without doing one backward seek. There's a little bit more complexity to it and so on. So the prefetch threads, we added some intelligence to them to do some spatial analysis of the actual prefetch that was occurring. So as we identified that there was some situations where the metadata was sparse blocks, but there were lots of blocks in, you know, a given locality. So instead of, you know, you've got a 2 megabyte range of data, range of the file system, and you've got 50 separate blocks of metadata in there. Now, what we'd previously been doing is 50 separate IOs with seeks between them and maybe seeking backwards and forwards. No. We've got bandwidth to burn. Read the whole damn lot in one IO and throw away the bits that don't have metadata in them. Right. So instead of taking 50 seeks to do it, we take one seek and a little bit of bandwidth. We've got bandwidth to burn. And the result of that is that we substantially reduced the amount of I.O. that was necessary to read the metadata in. So what we're effectively doing there, the concept behind that, was very similar to the way your hardware prefetcher for memory works. You use bandwidth to hide the latency, and that's what we're trying to do here. There's no point having hundreds of disks and gigabytes a second of I.O. if you're stuck doing random seeks of 4K everywhere and you're using 3 megabytes a second of bandwidth. That's what was happening. So one of the issues that we came across is that with the two queues, we could get to the point where the primary processing threads would stall. And that would occur in many cases because the metadata that was needed to proceed forwards was stuck in the behind queue. So the simple trick there was when the primary forwards queue started to run low, we switched queues and did one backwards seek and started processing that until we'd run out of the backwards queue. And at that point, we could then make progress with the forwards queue again. So the juggling of the queues enables to keep the threads running and running as fast as possible. That's effectively what happens. I'm not talking about the implementation of it as such here, but the concepts. You don't need to know the fact that it'll be one queue as an implementation eventually and all that sort of thing. So one of the key things was the... Bad what?
Yeah.
You don't have bad blocks in your file system. Yeah. No, we don't. That's something that we... Well, yeah, you throw away the disk, you've got RAID 5 or RAID 6, you just rebuild it. That's the usual process. You never see that. You can't do anything about that. No, we're not going to do that. That's a block layer problem. That's not a file system problem. Yeah. The complexity is not worth going near. That's right. Yeah. I wish. Yeah. So going back to the block cache. It wasn't working particularly well on Linux. I mean, it worked well on IRIX, or so we thought, because we didn't have any caching to begin with, and any improvement there was noticeable. But it wasn't working particularly well for Linux, and that's why we started looking into what was going on. And we discovered that there were some interesting I/O patterns between the different phases of repair. In the metadata was read in different block sizes. So in one phase we'll read inode chunks, which would be 16K on disk, and they'd end up in the cache. And then we'd come along and in another phase we'd read them in clusters, which were only 8K. And so of course the 8K IOs weren't found in the cache because it was trying to match on offset and length. They're different. So basically we were throwing away the cache between the phases. Which meant we had to read all the metadata in again. It's not very efficient, really. Just by doing the simple thing of making all the I/O sizes the same meant that we didn't have that problem and rereads of metadata went away between phases. So in phase six, we're doing directory scanning. It used its own unique directory scanning code, inode scanning code, which was different to what was done in phase 3 and 4. And it was suboptimal. So we used the same inode scanning as phase 3 and 4, so if it was already in the cache, then we didn't actually have to do it again. And as a result, we could visit the directories and inodes counting links and checking links in a much more IO efficient manner, and that resulted in a much lower runtime. We haven't yet parallelized that. We haven't needed to. And phase 7, the link count verification, it did another scan of the inodes to actually count the links and check that they were the same as what was calculated in phase 6. Now, that was because we were throwing away the inode counts in phase 3. So, we just keep them in memory for a little bit longer and we don't need to do any I/O in phase 7 now. And that goes a lot faster because of it. We only do I/O if there's actually a difference in the counts, and that's to work out what went wrong, how to fix it. Can't avoid that. So we didn't get rid of the per allocation group parallelism. We enhanced it further by being able to select how far apart the allocation groups are that you want to read. So if you've got a volume where you have the first four allocation groups on a set of disks and the next four on another set of disks and the next four on another set of disks, so they can actually operate completely independently, you'd set the AG stride to 4. And so your parallel threads would be operating independently on different sets of disks, so they don't interfere with one another. That also gave us, if we were CPU-bound processing allocation group, it also meant that we would split the processing across multiple CPUs, and when you've got lots of CPUs, you want to use them. The other thing that this gave us is that with the block caching and so on, we could basically fully parallelize phase 4 without needing any I/O. The block cache was completely populated. We just spawn off as many threads as we've got allocation groups and do the whole lot as fast as we can. At this point, we started to see problems with, we were testing larger and larger file systems, and now the actual amount of information we were caching in memory was greater than the memory that we actually had. And so we now started to see the size of the block cache causing problems. We were swapping it to disk. So we had to optimize the reclaim so that it was smart enough to keep stuff around that was going to be needed again, as opposed to stuff that we probably won't need. So we started looking at how likely various blocks were to be reused again and associating priorities with them. Generally, if it was just a set of inodes, they had the lowest priority because we can easily do sequential scans to bring in inodes. But if, for example, there was a piece of dependent metadata that required a large seek across the disk to read in, that was a more important thing to keep because that big seek causes more performance problems or slowdowns than doing sequential inode reading. If it was a backward seek, that was more important than something that required a forward seek. Yeah? When the block cache fills up, it's basically got a set of least recently used lists, and it will put them there priority ordered.
So one of the things that were pretty easy to do
That's the default priority that we use. If we have the cache, with phase 3 and phase 4, they do read the same blocks again. And so if you've got enough memory to keep everything around, then we don't ever actually throw them out. We don't throw them out until we've overflowed the cache. You can throw them away at that point, yeah. So various things got different priorities. And then we started to discover that it was still really slow, and the reason why we were using so much memory in this cache was that we were allocating and freeing blocks all the time, and we were fragmenting the heap badly, like increasing memory usage by a factor of 10. It was really amazing. And just by using a simple list of blocks that instead of freeing them straight back to the heap, we just left them there for a little while and reused those ones first. We basically removed all of the heap fragmentation from the system, and XFS repair went from using about 10 times as much memory as it should to close to what the theoretical numbers are. So, go on. Let's go and re-implement libc. Okay, yeah, sure. 10 lines of code to do a free list. I'm not going to write a memory allocator if we can do that. I'm lazy. Right, John? Yes. Ten lines of code. Come on. I don't need to do it again. Finding and fixing that particular problem meant that we were much less likely to run out of memory until you got more inodes in the file system, of course. Go on.
So you're doing order reads as well as the VM. So the VM thinks pages are dirty. So it's boxes instead of anything.
Yeah.
Did you guys ever experiment using mmap reads or the another read, or did you just discount it
because then you get read ahead thrashing.
You can't. I just wonder if you guys discounted it or tried it instead of
It wasn't really considered because of the problems, as we knew that we would be running out of memory, and if we're using memmap at that point, we're likely to be ending up swapping stuff and read ahead thrashing and so on. We just wanted to avoid the whole VM problems. Shove it off into a little box and ignore it.
You can make memmap upswing for ones directly.
I don't even want... You know what MLOC does to the VM. No, I put it in a little box and ignore it. Simple solution. I will get to that in a minute. I'll go through. I'll get to it in a second. I've got a data point on one of the slides coming up that will tell you how it compares. Okay, so we were using various test file systems. One of the things that we had to do was generate test images for file systems. Customers tend not to want to give us images of their file system. They like to keep their data private. And at this point in time, we didn't have the metadump utility to take images that were obfuscated and used zeros instead of real data. So we generated a whole bunch of different file systems and then at the same time developed the metadump image so that we could restore, take an image of the file system and restore them quickly. Because generating 300 million inodes in a file system with the directory structure and so on takes a couple of days to do. You don't want to have, look, I repaired it. Okay, now I need to test this one. Okay, I'll sit here for a couple of days waiting for it to build. With metadump, we could restore, once we'd backed up that image, we could restore a 300 million inode file system image in about 5 minutes. Lots faster. So the way we generated the file system in the first place was to try and simulate an aged file system. There's fragmentation, there's non-contiguous blocks, the directories are fragmented, there's holes all over the place, and so on. So, we basically ran a script that ended up making the file system completely I/O bound. Created variable size files, variable number of files per directory, variable directory depth in the tree. We use small direct IOs to synchronous IOs to force fragmentation to occur. We used sparse files. We punched holes into files. We deleted files instead of creating them at random opportunities. And we ended up with relatively large and fragmented directory structures, physically separate inode chunks, so the metadata was always separate. With the fragmented files, we ended up with, not just nice, extent lists that were sitting in the inode. We had nice big B trees full of metadata as well. So we were testing across the range of structures that we'll see. We have been doing that, yes. I don't think so. It's just it's a recursive shell script. Something like that, yeah. Okay, so... Question? Okay, thank you. Okay, so the results. The first test system we were using, just the small SATA disk, the sort of workstation or desktop that people have these days, varying capacities or various numbers of inodes in them and whatnot. I won't go through all of these slides, I'll just point out a few things that have been interest for them. Okay, so just to give you an idea of what we've got here is the time breakdown across the different phases. We have the baseline, which is 2718, 2718 plus the Agami patch, which had the threading. We've got 2820 to show you how bad it was. And then we've got 294, which has got all of these changes that we've just talked about in it. Okay. So as you can see, when we start looking at threading on a single disk in phase three, we add the prefetch threads. It actually goes slower in those phases when we've got small amounts of inodes. The reason why 294 is faster is that it disappeared from phase six and phase seven. There's no time spent in them anymore because of the fact that we're using cached data that we picked up in phase three and phase four. So they're the key things. And as a result, the overall run time went down on that. So if we now go to 1.5 million inodes in that file system, so you've got a mail DIRS, or something of the sort like that, We now start to see that the threading in the prefetch threading does actually start to show some improvements. The Agami patch was once again slightly slower, but the way we're doing the prefetch now is slightly faster. And once again, phase 6 and phase 7 basically disappear. These are all Linux. This is a dual processor, 2 gigahertz AMD 64 with 2 gigabytes of RAM and a 250 gig SATA disk. Like I said, typical desktop these days. We're getting 20% improvement in runtime there on that. At 1.65 million inodes, that's XFS repair fitting completely within memory. 5.7 million inodes, it doesn't fit in memory anymore. So what happens there? Phase 3, the baseline. Phase 4, identical runtime. Phase 6, it's scanning again. Phase 7, it's scanning again. That shows that we're rereading almost exactly the same set of data in phase 3, phase 4, phase 6, and phase 7. We read the same thing 4 times off disk. Not particularly good. The Agami patch, it's doing the same thing again. We're basically not getting any effect from the caching and the read ahead and the prefetch on that. And because it's doing prefetch and so on, it's slightly slower in most of those phases. And so it goes slower once you get limited memory in this situation. Comparatively, 2820 looks good in this one. It's pretty much the only one. and 294 by default, we can see that in phase 3 and phase 4, we have read some data again, but we've read about half as much. In phase 6, there's a little bit of I/O that occurs. Phase 7, there's none. The caching with the way we're doing the eviction under low memory conditions is actually starting to work. And the result there is that we're going 50% faster. We've cut runtime in half in that case. Now, one of the things that we noticed here is that we haven't quite got the cache size incorrect. We don't have the heuristics that detect what the most optimal cache size is. We can't quite get it right. We've got no feedback as when the machine is actually, or the process is actually starting to be swapped out. And so 294 was actually being swapped at that point. So with the bhash equals 64K option, that limited the size of the block device cache. That was a carefully chosen number such that 5.7 million inodes fitted into 64K of cache and it didn't swap. And the result of that is that we've chopped another 700 seconds off the runtime there just because it's now not swapping.
The issue is if it's not completely obvious what they're going to pick there, you don't want to rerun it. If possible, repeatedly, just to work out what
number. That's right. Well, we knew because of the work we were doing, we were trying to work out, because we've got to work out what the heuristics are for the memory scaling and the size of the caches. That's what we were trying to find there.
Being hash reminds me generally of the bypass size, and I've been bitten by bypass size tuning.
It's gone. In most cases, you will not need to touch it. This is a demonstration point to show that we've still got work to do to tune the. Ignore the name. That's the number of entries. The name is actually a holdover from the 2.8 series and whatnot. We need to change it. So I probably should have put cache size or something like that there instead of used the command line option. Yeah. So as you can see though, 294 is substantially faster in this situation, and with more tuning of the defaults and so on, we can get it to go even faster still. And 17 million inodes, I don't think many people have that many inodes on their 250 gig disk. But once again, you see the same sort of thing. The interesting thing here with 2820, note that it's got a bhash equal 4K. The reason for that is that if we didn't do that, the ROM killer kicked in and killed the process. It failed to run at this many inodes. Yeah. Did I say we had some failures? So just out of curiosity, the scaling, when the cache fits in memory versus the cache doesn't fit in memory, you know, or the number of inodes doesn't fit in the cache. So we can see that 294 is, you know, on average taking quite a bit less than the baseline, quite a bit less than the Gami patch. And when we start to get cache size larger than memory, the difference is even larger. This is the one, that, who can point out the one data point that's of interest here? Yeah. XFS repaired that file system in 275 seconds. EXT3 took 47 minutes. We're processing at about 6,000 inodes a second in this situation off a single disk. EXT3 is able to do just over 500 a second. There's no point, it just takes so long. There's only so many hours that we had to do this. Well, when we tried it on the larger ones, you know, it was, we ended up killing because we didn't want, it only takes 20 seconds for XFS to do it, so, you know, what's the, yeah, I mean, it's not really that interesting to us. Oh, well, we didn't wait around for the 37 million inode tests on the larger block device. After 2 days, we killed it. We were more interested in running XFS repair for 2 days. Not of interest. Now, we've done various things with other file systems before and found that really there isn't that much interest in doing it. So, bigger file system, okay, you've got a server, it's got 25 disks in it, it's using RAID 5, we're striping across multiple RAID 5 volumes here. Larger inode counts, 6 million, 30 million and 300 million. So, once again, we have the numbers here. That looks rather good, doesn't it? You know, 5.5 terabytes, 6 million inodes in 150 seconds. Inodes. 8 minutes. Okay, now it's getting interesting. 300 million inodes. We've gone from taking 13 and a half hours down to about 2 hours. Gets better. So let's start playing around with parallelism. Oh, AG stride equal one, so we're now parallelizing with, you know, threads across multiple AGs and they're just processing ones across it. We're now down to 57 minutes, 300 million inodes from 13 hours. Now we add another, you know, we go to 16 prefetch threads, so we're doing all of the AGs in the file system at once. We're down to 43 minutes. We've gone from 13 and a half hours to 43 minutes. So that's the runtime scaling there that you can see. The Agami patch did pretty well for what it was doing. It halved the runtime on a file system like that, but like I said, we can do better. More runtime scaling, you're closer. Okay, just to give you an idea of the number of inodes. Remember that one that showed EXT3 doing 500 inodes a second? 113,000 inodes a second. That's the big number there. That's the number that customers like. Prefetch threads. Yeah, so that's doing all, you know, the file system had 16 AGs in it, that's doing, you know, all 16 AGs in parallel ones. So we're I/O bound there. Give me more disks and we'll go faster again. Just a summary of the low memory behavior. The machine we're testing on had 48 gig of RAM, so only the 300 million inode test was actually running out of cache. So we thought we'd better test with some lower memory. So with 2 gig of RAM, we can see that 294 still maintains the fact that it's somewhat faster. Even, you know, it's still under low memory conditions, it's twice as fast as the baseline that we had that was running in all 48 gig of RAM. So it performs a lot better. So after all that, what do we still have to do? You know, we've made it so much better now, and you can all go off and, you know, fix your file system so much faster. There's still more work to do, of course. We still use a lot of memory for free space indexing. We have an extent file system, you know, which is efficient. We use bitmaps for indexing free space in XFS repair. Yeah. So why does it take a terabyte of memory to repair a 300 terabyte file system? Well, there's a terabyte of bitmaps.
It's any consolation, it's reading stuff
to. Yeah. We're changing it to B-trees. So effectively, we're introducing more efficient indexing structures that use less memory. Using extents for indexing free space will cut, instead of using a bitmap, which is, 128 megabytes per terabyte of space, we'll be able to represent that with 16 bytes. A small, small improvement in, memory usage, that will effectively allow us to repair much, much larger file systems in small memory configs. At the moment, you just get limited until you add, 150 gigabytes of swap. So this will actually improve things substantially. In terms of performance, we're going to multi-thread phase 6, even though it's not taking up much time, there's still improvements there. We have directory name hash checking scalability problems. If you've got a directory with 10 million files in it, when we actually check all the hashes for it, it slows down a little. The hash isn't all that big, and putting 10 million entries in it is awful. Trees again, yes. Introduce more efficient indexing structures. and then, of course, we've saved all this memory. Yeah, let's use it for caching. we can go faster because we can cache more, and we don't have to do more I.O. So that will translate directly into better performance. In terms of robustness, phase one can... Well, it acts suboptimally when you zero half your file system. People do this, or they have a disk failure out of a stripe, or they lose two disks in a RAID. They still want to get what data is left there off the file system, so they put new disks in it, let it recover, and repair it. Phase one often breaks in those situations. So there's work to do there. I know how to... Pardon? Yeah. I mean, I can give you a recipe that involves lots of interesting commands that will put stuff back in the file system sufficiently for repair to be able to fix it. But that's deep mojo. when we have badly broken directories, they don't get put back together real well, and so you end up with lots of inodes and lost and found, and you get to do the magic number shuffle. What's behind this 10-digit number? Oh, look, that's an MP3. What was it called? I don't know. I'll listen to it. Good fun. Not. Especially when there's 100,000 files there to do that with. So we can greatly improve that as well. So that's the sorts of things that we're looking at doing at the moment with repair to move on from the work that we've already done to make it faster and faster. So... That's it. Questions? Matthew?
You're still in these sort of case, but you're going to see modern sort of SPs to create
a but that's only when you break it.
Right. But is there, if you want to create an IP beyond this format, say, is there low-hanging fruit that would allow you to reduce this?
There'd be things that we could do, like splitting the metadata and data within the allocation group. So the metadata is always in like the lowest 10% of it, which means that we wouldn't have to scan the entire allocation group. We'd just be able to do effectively sequential large block reads across a small chunk of the allocation group and get all the metadata, throw away the holes out of it, and we don't have to seek anywhere. So once again, trading bandwidth off for seek time. Why is that a disk format change? Do you trust the allocator? Do you trust? If you don't tell the file system that metadata is only going to be in this lower 10%, you still have to go and scan the rest of it. You don't trust it. There's issues like that. In repair, you cannot trust one single thing that the file system tells you. You get a single bit error in one structure, and you're toast if you're relying on that particular structure for what bits you have to check.
That's why Valerie was named that.
Hi Val, what's her name? There are other file systems that do that. DualFS is an example of just file systems that separate metadata and data and can be checked very quickly because of that. I have a patch series that is currently touching about 10,000 lines of code that is starting to bring checksums in for this exact purpose. That's a big disk format change. Checksums within all the B-tree nodes and everything of the sort like that mean we have to change everything, every single on-disk structure. When it works.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's appreciated. Yeah. Any other questions?
You
or you can talk to me. We're publishing the work that we've done, so the same techniques can be used on the other file systems. Val has already done multi-threading for ext3 repair, posted a patch for it, which uses the block device prefetching and population technique, the one that we threw away.
Yeah. Well, it's very different. But yes, you want to get faster.
Good plot.